Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, episode number 25. The road to hell is paved with adverbs. Stephen King.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. By the way, guys, if you want to get access to hundreds and hundreds of screenplays that you can take a look at, read, get inspired by, study, just go to bulletproofscreenplay.com and you can download screenplays that I've organized by screenwriter, by genre, and even TV scripts, some of the best pilot scripts of all time. So definitely check it out. It's a great resource, bulletproofscreenplay.com. Now, today on the show, we have Lucy V. Hay. She is an author, a script consultant, and a screenwriter. She's written books on the screenwriting craft, like writing and selling drama screenplays, writing and selling thriller screenplays, and writing diverse characters for fiction, TV, or film. She's also one of the UK's best-known script consultants, and she does amazing work through her blog and website, bangtowrite.com. And I want to invite her on the show to talk shop and see what her perspective was on the craft and how she helps her clients get those stories toit. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Lucy V. Hay. I'd like to welcome to the show Lucy Hay. Thank you so much for jumping on.
Well, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
I know it's taken us a minute to get to this point.
Yes. I think it was 6 months, I think, before we could align our schedules.
I know. Our schedules are a bit hectic, but I'm so glad we finally be able to make it work. I've been wanting to get you on the show to pick your brain a little bit about the business. But before we jump in, how did you even get started in the film business?
It's a really kind of long and involved story.
So just a short version then.
Okay, the short version is I did a degree in screenwriting for film and television. Back in the day, I was here in the UK doing that course in 2000. I graduated 2003. I was a single mother back in those days, and I didn't have any childcare, and I really wanted to be involved in screenwriting in some way. I wasn't really sure how. I just knew that I wanted to be part of the industry, and I really loved the development of stories and just really kind of being involved in whichever way I could, basically. Mm-hmm. And during the time that I was on the degree, I had to do some work experience to pass the course. And during that time, I managed to get some work experience reading screenplays for a literary agent and various other places as well, schemes and a lottery funding initiative and various things like that. So when I came out of university, I thought, well, you know, maybe there is room for someone who can actually read people's screenplays and actually consult on screenplays. Mm-hmm. To actually help people get better and have better opportunities and better ways of kind of breaking in, because when I was reading in the spec pile for agents and for producers and for various schemes and competitions, one thing I noticed was that there were a lot of first drafts or really obvious mistakes, and people weren't really doing peer review so much then. It was all before social media, it was all before blogs and things like that. So I thought, well, you know, maybe there's a room for somebody like me who could be some sort of advisor, and then I can be involved in screenwriting and with screenwriters. And the it was just, it took off really quickly, and I thought I would be dealing predominantly with new writers who were wanting to break in. And whilst that was true, I very quickly started getting clients who were much higher up the ladder, and I was reading for people who were working in television, who's working in movies, and before I knew it, I was even had some clients who were, you know, pretty famous. I was like, wow. So I figured I must be doing something all right. And I think one of the key elements for that, for kind of making the splash that I did, was probably the blog. I was one of the first people to kind of get into screenwriting as a blogger. Although there were lots of screenwriting blogs from screenwriters' point of view, there weren't so many about the actual craft of screenwriting in those days, especially in the UK. Mm-hmm. There was things like John August's blog, and around the same time Go Into the Story started, and various other websites, Wordplay, ones like that, but they were all very, very American. And I saw that there was this kind of gap in the market, if you like, for a UK screenwriting advice, specifically as like a teaching blog. I dived in with both feet, and so like 10, 15 years later, here we go.
Awesome. Now, what are some of the biggest mistakes you see in first-time screenwriters?
Oh, God. I think probably the first thing would be that they have an idea, or they see a trailer in their head, or they see some like imagery in their head, or maybe just a character or something like that. And they don't really know what the story is. They don't know what it's about. They don't know how plotting works. They're thinking probably really deeply thematically, but they're not necessarily thinking about the actual blow by blows of the plot. And so they get themselves all tied up in knots as to what the story is really about versus what's literally happening. And so they end up writing these crazy, crazy drafts where, you know, you can read a whole like 120 page screenplay and you still have no clue what's happened. You know, it's just like an explosion. It's like a stream of consciousness all over. And that's probably what everyone does, I think, at some point. I know I did that. Literally everyone, when they start out, whether they're writing a screenplay or a short story or a novel or whatever, they can't really get their thoughts in order. They know that there's bits and pieces that they want to say, and maybe they've got a really interesting voice or a really interesting idea or an interesting character, but they just can't make it all gel together. So I think that's probably the first kind of most obvious thing that happens. Another thing that happens is people's concepts and log lines just are really half-baked. You know, they either don't make sense, or they're really derivative, or they're just boring, and you kind of go, what the hell is that? I don't know what that is. And that usually happens after they've comes the realization that, oh, actually I can't just write the stream of consciousness, I've got to try and kind of organize it. But then they might over organize it, or organize it in such a way that it's still not recognizable, or has come out of the left field, or is too samey to what's gone before. Other things that are really obvious is dialogue. There's far too much dialogue in the average spec screenplay. Even if it's good, they probably still don't need a third or even half of as much as what they've got. Mm-hmm. So they forget that it's a visual medium. You know, a lot of writers fall in love with dialogue, and some of them are really good at dialogue, but they forget the visuals. Alternatively, maybe they go too far the other way, and it's really nice and visual, but again, it's not coherent. You don't know what's really happening, and so you actually need more dialogue, but that doesn't happen very often. It's nearly always too much dialogue, I find, which I think is really interesting. Other things, structure is a big issue. People just don't know how structure works because they haven't done enough research into what structure means to them. Lots of people say, oh, well, you only need a beginning, a middle, and an end, and not necessarily in that order, which is what Bang to Right believes as well. Mm-hmm. But you also do need to know how other people have structured things before you. And that doesn't mean you have to use pictograms and worksheets and all that kind of stuff. But it does mean that if your movie is like Blade Runner or is like Alien or is like whatever, you do need to know how those stories were structured and why they were so interesting to you and why you want to do something in that kind of vein. Because if you don't know how...
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
They crafted their stuff, then how are you going to know how to craft your own stuff? So it doesn't really matter how you structure. You know, it doesn't matter if you use Save the Cat. It doesn't matter if you use three acts or the mini movie method or the 22 steps. Use whatever you like. No one cares, but it needs some sort of structure. And very often things go wrong in structure, like a very classic one would be starting too early. So you end up with a really lumpy kind of first act in particular. Or it starts really well, but then it has a massive dip in the middle, and or you end up running on the spot or something like that. Or resolutions, you know, the endings can be too rushed and it's like, oh, it's all over. What the hell just happened? That kind of thing. So those are the kind of classic structural issues. And then finally, I would say the kind of the next obvious one would be characterization. People don't know what good characterization is and what is good characterization. Well, I mean, how long is a piece of string? But the two things that you need for good characterization is a role function, what they're doing in the story, and then also their motivation, which is why they're doing things, you know, why, what do they want in the story? Very often writers will understand motivation, but they won't necessarily understand role function. Role function are things like protagonist and antagonist. They usually get those okay. Protagonist usually these days. Antagonist can be a little bit more up in the air, but usually most of them can get those two main ones. It's usually the secondary characters where things go wrong, the mentors, the Jobsworths, the love interests, you know, all those kind of secondary supporting kind of characters will go wrong. They'll be boring, or they will have overthought them somehow. I mean, very often people get really angry about love interests always being female, for instance. But rather than actually changing the love interest to a male and making it a gay love story, for example, which might make it a bit more fresh, they will turn it into, like, I read a lot of rom-coms that have no romance in. It's like, why is there no romance in this rom-com? Which sounds insane, and that's because it is, because we need romance in a rom-com. And if you don't like the fact that certain characters are love interests, for instance, then don't write rom-com, you know, write something else. But people try to reinvent the wheel a lot, and things get out of control very quickly. I mean, even an anti-rom-com has still got romance in, you know, it's just that the, right, you know, an anti-rom-com is like a sad rom-com, you know, it's funny, but it's tragic because they don't end up together. You know, something like 500 Days of Summer, that was a great anti-rom-com. Something like Crazy Stupid Love was an anti-rom-com. You know, it's all about the relationships where things go wrong and maybe you won't recover from them, but you learn something. And so it's still hopeful and it's still useful in it's not a tragedy where everything is ruined. But they don't know the difference between a rom-com with no romance and an anti-rom-com. And I think what I'm really talking to you about now, mm-hmm, is the fact that writers don't do enough research. They don't do enough research into the craft and they don't do enough research into their art. You know, if you want to write a rom-com, you should be watching as many rom-coms as possible. If you want to write a horror, you should be reading and watching as much horror as you can. You should be reading novels in that genre. You should be immersing yourself in your craft and also in the styles that you want to do. It sounds obvious, and that's because it is. But unfortunately, a lot of writers don't really get that. They say, I haven't got enough time to write. So I want to write every night. And it's like, well, you'd actually get your writing done a lot quicker if you immersed yourself in the situation. That's what pro writers do. They immerse themselves in a story and in that story world.
Well, so what you're telling me is that my idea to bring back dinosaurs and have them in a park is probably not going to fly nowadays.
Well, I mean, you could give it a try, but I think someone might have got there before you. I mean, certainly, everybody loves dinosaurs, everyone.
I'm joking.
I know. But if you actually could find some sort of twist on that dinosaur story, then by all means, we're talking there about genre busting. You know, if you can bring us something that we've seen before that's pre-sold, like dinosaurs, like vampires, like werewolves, like whatever,
zombies.
Yeah, if you can actually bring us something that we've never seen before and make somebody like me, a script reader or a script editor, go, God, why haven't I seen this before? Then they're going to pass it up the chain to their boss and say, you'll never guess what. I've seen, a new take on the vampire myth. And they'll be like, you're joking. It's like, no, I really have. Here you go. And that's what gets everybody excited, is this notion of genre busting and bringing something that we've never seen before. I mean, we're talking about the same but different. And most writers do get that after a while, but they probably concentrate too much on the sameness and not enough on the difference.
Now, since you've read so many scripts, what do script writers look for in a screenplay specifically? Like the little giveaways. I'm like, oh, this is I'm gonna pass this and take it up the ladder.
So a script reader, what does a script reader look for? Yeah, we're looking for something that looks like a script in the first instance. You wouldn't believe some of the
stuff written in Word, not so much.
Oh no, thank you.
Text edit. No.
No, thanks. So something that looks like a script in the first instance is always a plus. We have this thing now. I mean, everybody knows about the first 10 pages and how it's got to, do what it's, set up the story and introduce the characters and make us understand where it's going in the first 10 pages, even if that's a lie. But in real terms, because there's so many submissions now, you need to really start on page one with a bang. You really, really need to grab someone massively on page one now. You need a great visual. If you've got dialogue on page one, then it needs to be a really cool line. It can't be something really boring. And the average first page of a screenplay is really dull. It's somebody literally walking into the frame and talking about something and doing, oh, this is a big introduction scene of some kind. And it's like, that's not interesting. When we want to start with something really intriguing or shocking or devastating or interesting, something that makes me go, I read screenplays all day, for God's sakes, and yet I hardly ever sit up and go, ooh, on page one. Because I'm used to things being, not necessarily grabbing me. But that very first image, that opening image, has got to really grab me. I mean, I read one yesterday that I was blown away by. It was awesome. It was the first thing after reading it was call up all my friends and say, you'll never guess what, I read a brilliant page one. And they'd be like, no way, because script readers don't read brilliant page ones very often. So that's part of it. Another thing that we're looking for is confidence. You wouldn't believe how kind of apologetic a lot of writers write. You've got to really own the page. I suppose that's what people mean when they talk about voice, this notion of confidence and actually owning the page and actually saying, this is my script. We don't want all these vanilla screenplays that are really just really bland. We want something that's going to grab us. Again, we're talking about this notion of being really hooked. So not just imagery, but the way you write it as well, a sense of confidence, a sense of voice. Another thing that we want as well is an intriguing character of some kind, something that we haven't seen before. Because although sometimes storylines can feel a bit like they're, like we've seen them before, I'm so bored of seeing the same characters over and over again. And there'll be the same characters in different genres and different styles. You know, people have got to think a bit more outside the box. And I'm pleased to say that we're actually seeing a lot more diversity now. You know, there was a point where it was all male leads, they were all white all the time. And of course, there are some great films and TV shows with white male leads. It would be absurd to say that there aren't. There are some really, really good ones. But does it have to be that guy every time? You know, what more can you bring to this character, this situation, by making it a woman, by making it a person with a disability, by making it somebody who's gay or straight or transgender?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And just, you know, just mixing it up a bit. And just a great sense of structure. It's so rare to find a well-structured screenplay. It's so rare. So every time that happens, and it makes it so easy to read. And when something's an easy read, you read it fast and you pass it on fast. If you have to read it and it takes a long time, your interest is going to wane. You're going to forget. You're going to put it to one side. You're going to forget to call your boss or your collaborator or whatever. Whereas if you read it and go, wow, amazing, you're going to be picking up the phone. You're going to be writing an email. You're going to be writing a tweet going, oh my god, I just read something amazing, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and that creates buzz, and that makes you far more likely as a writer to get onto someone's radar.
Very good. That's an excellent answer, by the way. Excellent answer. Now, what are some tips on selling dramas in today's marketplace, which they are just so difficult? But I'd love to hear some ideas of yours.
Well, of course, I wrote a whole book on this called Writing and Selling Drama Screenplays. But basically, the potted version of saying, you know, how to sell a drama, because you're absolutely right. Drama is a dirty word in the current marketplace. You know, there's a lot of producers out there selling their dramas as thrillers, for example, when they're not really thrillers at all. Although some of them do a very good job. I mean, I saw one of my case studies in the book is called Hours, and it's by the writer of Arrival, Eric Heizura, and it was his directorial debut, and was a fantastic drama. It was about fatherhood. It was about responsibility. It was just beautiful. It was really, really good, and it was the last job that the late Paul Walker from Fast and the Furious did.
Yes, of course, I remember the movie.
Yeah, it was a great film. I loved it. But they did sell it as a thriller, the distributor. They had him on the front cover looking all rugged and stressed. Mm-hmm. It was going, you know, like it was, and they had him on the back and he's carrying a gun and all that kind of stuff. It does look like a thriller. So some distributors and some producers as well will sell dramas as thrillers, especially if it's got a very compelling kind of survival element in it, like Ours, because it was set in the New Orleans hurricane.
Sure. Yeah.
So if you've got some sort of hook like a survival situation, then maybe you could do that as a thriller. But that is a bit of a cheat, really. But it can work. Having said that, you can sell it as a thriller. You could also sell it as a comedy as well, because there was a movie about cancer called Stepmom, starring Susan Sarandon and Julia Roberts. Beautiful story about an ex-wife who has to leave the care of her children with the new wife's husband. She's dying of cancer, the ex-wife, and she has to leave her young children with Julia Roberts, the new wife, and their father. And it's all about the two women getting to know one another and actually getting over resentment and the unfairness of the situation, because of course she doesn't want to die and all this kind of stuff. And it was heartbreaking and beautiful. Really, really well done. But they sold it as a comedy. And although there were bits that were funny, because it was very much from the tragic element of, you know, if you didn't laugh, you cry. It wasn't a comedy. It was a drama. But the distributor sold it as a comedy. I remember the trailer. And
I do too.
Yeah, and I don't think they even mentioned cancer in the trailer.
No, they do not. Of course not. Who's going to watch that movie?
Exactly. So, but it was a beautiful film. I saw it on television by accident, and I was weeping buckets. It was so good, brilliant performances. So, so thriller or comedy, you know, trying to give it that kind of sense can work, again, with this notion of issues as well. Things like cancer, things like teenage pregnancy with Juno, you know, you can give that as a hook, you know, using issues as a hook to sell them can work. That said, when it comes to drama, generally, you're not going to sell a drama in the classic sense, like you would sell a genre piece, not in the current marketplace. So basically what happens is you're not selling stuff in terms of, actually, you know, getting a check and going in and, you know, saying Jaws in space and getting them to do a blank check to you and all that kind of stuff, like, you know, like everybody wants. But basically what you're doing is you're writing the best drama that you can think of, the best devastating one, both best whimsical one, best survivalist one, whatever that is. And you're recruiting, and it's kind of like a recruitment drive. You're kind of getting people on board with you. You kind of essentially call yourself the writer producer, if you like, or and you're recruiting everybody onto your journey and making them kind of get on board with you and help you make this film. I mean, I was reading about I've forgotten his name. The guy who was the producer of Dallas Buyers Club.
And, yes, I forgot his name, but yes, I know who you're talking about.
Yes, and it's just completely gone out of my head, which is really annoying.
And that's a straight drama. That is a straight drama.
Exactly. But of course, it's about issues, mm-hmm. and it was a very kind of prescient kind of issue, because of course it introduced to the mainstream the notion of transgender characters, it was something that was quite dark, and also had some moments of light and shade, and made a massive cultural impact in the same way that probably something like Philadelphia did, mm-hmm. with Tom, yeah. Hanks about 20 years before, and interestingly around the same time that Philadelphia was made and was getting all its Oscars with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks, Dallas Buyers Club was doing the rounds. It was literally in development for about 22, 23 years. Originally, apparently, Woody Harrelson was going to play Matthew McConaughey's part, which you can see, can't you? Mm-hmm. And it just stayed in development hell for a long, 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 long time because nobody wanted to make that film. And anyway, the producer, Cassian Newells, that's his name, Cassian, yes. Newells, lost finance multiple times to make Dallas Buyers Club, because basically it was his pet project. It was his passion project. He really, really wanted to make this movie because he thought it was important, and he was absolutely right. And eventually, when he lost it for the third time, he just got out his Rolodex or his Filofax or however he does it and just called people up begging them for money. And he eventually found someone who he said, look, mate, I gave you your start in filmmaking, so now give me the money to make this film. And the guy said, no, I don't want to make that film about AIDS and stuff. It's too much of a downer. I don't want to do it. And he goes, look, it's really important. We're going to win all the awards. It's going to make a massive cultural impact. I guarantee it. You know, Cassian Newells had that much belief. And the guy said, you know what? I'm going to give you the money. But when you go to the Oscar ceremony, you've got to take me with you.
Right.
And of course, the rest is history. They won all those Oscars, and Cassian Newells took his mates to the Oscars with him, you know, and it's like, wow, you know, you've got to have that kind of belief. When you're making a drama, you have to understand that unless you're willing to get behind it 100% like that, then it's probably not worth writing a drama. You probably want to be doing something else. You know, you probably want to write a horror or something that you can sell a lot easier. Because if you think that writing a drama and selling it just because it's lower budget than average is going to make it easier, it's not. It's still like 30 million times harder to make a drama than a genre piece. So that's always really worth thinking about. Whenever my writers come to me and say, I really want to do a drama, I say, well, how are you going to do this? And if they look at me blankly, I go, oh, dear. Oh, dear. Right. Because you don't know the half of it, you know. But, it, you know, sometimes they'll come to me and say, right, I'm going to make this amazing drama because this subject matter is really important to me and I've got this strategy. I'm going to get the money from this scheme. I'm going to get the money from these kind of product placements and various investors and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to take it to all the various film festivals. I'm going to win loads of awards. I'm going to make sure it gets into the Oscars. I'm going to go all out to go, you know, to the nth degree with that. And every time somebody comes to me with that, I go, fantastic, I will help you, because they know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Dramas are such a unique genre in film, because they're the one that kind of like you can easily tweak it to make it a comedy, or you could tweak it to make it a thriller, or at least have those elements in it for selling points of view, where, you know, sometimes there are those straight dramas like Dallas Buyers Club. You know, I don't even remember if there was any humor. I think there had to have been a joke or two in there. But you can't sell that movie, obviously, as a comedy. Yeah. And the other genre that gets really abused is thriller. Now, what is the definition, in your opinion, of a thriller? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Well, thriller thrills. So, you know, that's kind of, you know, everybody knows that because it's in the name. But, you know, what does thrilling actually mean? And I think there's two kind of key things that are in a thriller. Again, something, I mean, both thriller and drama are two things that I feel really passionately about, which I had to, because I've written a book on each of these things.
Yes, you have.
In terms of thrillers, in terms of what I would call a definition of thrillers, is a thriller usually has some kind of element of mystery to it. They usually have to find out some sort of answer to a question of some kind, who is behind it all, if you like. Mm-hmm. And then it can be a straight mystery as well, you know, the notion of the whodunit as well. But even if it doesn't have a mystery element, because not every thriller has a mystery element, because at the end of the day, a thriller just has to thrill. It can just be exciting. That's the point. So I think what is predominantly the point of thrillers is that it's about the chase of some kind, whether they're looking for a mysterious answer to a question or whether they're literally chasing someone. It's about the chase, literally or metaphorically.
Now, is there, because I know horror films a lot of times can either be tweaked to be thrillers as well, because arguably, you know, I just watched It the other day and it definitely thrilled, you know, but it also scared. So how do you play around with that definition, or are we really just getting into the weeds?
No, I think there's a considerable difference between thriller and horror. A lot of people kind of mix them up and say that you know, that they're the same. And certainly there is some mixing within the genre. You know, thrillers can be horrifying and horrors can be thrilling, you know. But if you take it right down to the foundation levels, a thriller is for the chase and a horror is for the scares. You know, horror is supposed to scare you. And so, you know, sometimes you find being scared thrilling, and that's great. But is there a sense of mystery there? Is there a sense of chase there? Probably not necessarily. I mean, something like It, for example, is a classic horror because, yes, there are thrilling elements in it. I loved it when he jumped out of the fridge and out of the and all that kind of stuff. I loved all of that because it is thrilling to me because I enjoy being scared. But ultimately, It and arguably most of Stephen King's work in general is about vanquishing the beast. There is this bad thing and you have got to stop it. That's the point of horror. And so it's about being scared and it's about vanquishing the beast. And who could be more beastly than Pennywise? He's horrifying.
Oh my God. What a beautiful rendition of that novel. They did such a beautiful job.
It was really good.
Yeah, I can't wait for the sequel. I can't wait for chapter two.
Yeah, no, I can't. I mean, I enjoyed the first TV series version of it. Tim Curry, awesome. But a lot of the plotting was quite whack, really, it was just a bit lumpy and strange, and it really kind of, it was very 90s. There was a lot of really weird stuff going on.
And it was also a TV movie, so it wasn't an actual, you know, full blown feature film. So might have not taken as much time. Caliber of the writers might have been different. It could have been a whole sorts of reasonings. But yes, I did not see the Tim Curry version, or if I did, I didn't remember it as well. I do remember him, but this version, he was just eerie and scary, and it was beautifully done. Beautiful, and yeah. I love that was in the 80s. Because now we tap into the wonderful thing that's just running rampant right now over Hollywood and over movies in general is nostalgia. Can you talk a little bit about nostalgia and what is it right now? Because we've had nostalgia for a while. I mean, you can go back to examples like American Graffiti that was nostalgic for the 50s. And it's always a couple decades back, I notice. It's like 2 or 3 decades away, and then we can go back and be nostalgic about it. But the 80s has something very special about it. There is something unique about that 80s and now 90s too, both. Which
I don't think it's unique. I think it's just the fact that we're old now, you know. I mean, people who are 35 plus are looking back on times of the 80s and the 90s with such fondness because everything seemed simpler then. There was no social media, there was no people in your face with, you know, you could go away for the weekend, nobody could hassle you, you know. Now you've got bloody mobiles all the time.
We weren't at war. The economy was good for the most part.
Not necessarily. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on, certainly in the UK in the 80s. There's the miners' strikes. There was a massive recession. You know,
for us in the US, I mean, we had the Cold War, but the Cold War ended. The late 80s and 90s were pretty much an economic boom for us. And we weren't at a war until the 90s with the Desert Storm, but it wasn't like an ongoing war. Mm-hmm. Constantly, and it's just a much more complex time now, without question.
Yeah, I'm not sure it is actually. I think there's always been crazy things going on in the world. I think we just hear about them more
That's
now. You know, had all kinds of stuff going on in the 90s that we never heard about at the time. You know, the Taliban taking the stronghold and stopping all the women going to work, and you know, the Chechenian rebels and the destruction of the USSR and Yugoslavia was gone. And
I guess I think we were ignorant back then, and it's just we didn't get the information as much. It's just now we're overloaded with it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the genocides that were happening in places like Rwanda, for example, just every bit as bad as those things that ISIS are doing. And yet, apparently, these are the worst times that we've ever lived in. And actually, I think we've always lived in terrible times. And I think we've always lived in wonderful times. I think it depends where you are. And I think we're looking back with nostalgia for the 80s and 90s because we're looking through rose-tinted spectacles. Now, I loved my, you know, being a child, I loved being a teenager and all those kind of things. But I'm not denying the fact that I had problems and the world had problems at the time. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget. And the Victorians believed that nostalgia was actually a disease. You would actually become sick. You would actually become sick for the past. And I think that's what a lot of us do now. And of course, it's easier than ever to be sick for the past because, of course, you can look on the internet and see all these great things that you used to have or used to believe you had. And now you think that now the present is rubbish. And I think that's a real shame in lots of ways because, you know, you've only got now. There is only now.
There is only now. You don't have tomorrow. You don't have the past. It's all you have is now.
You know, none of us know how much time we have. And unfortunately, a lot of us waste it by worrying about things that have already gone, worrying about things that might not happen, and saying that everything about now is terrible. And, you know, everybody worries, everybody gets annoyed about stuff. You know, they've got a crap boss, or their teams let them down, or anything like that. But at the end of the day, you have to kind of try and keep gratitude in your heart for the fact that you're not dead.
that's a very good point. At the end of the day, like, you know what? You should be grateful that you're not dead. I mean, you're here. Might as well enjoy it while you're here and enjoy the present moment. And that's the only thing you really have control over. And I think that's a great way to write a character. Yeah. You know, because also characters a lot of times have the same neurosis that we have as human beings. Which I was going to ask you.
Psychology. I've suffered from depression.
Of course.
So, it can be easier said than done.
No, without question.
It can be easier said than done. Yeah, it's something, you know, a lot of people get really annoyed and say, oh, you know, when you say that, you're sticking the boot into people who have mental health issues. And it's like, no, I've got every sympathy for people with mental health issues. You know, life is hard. And sometimes, you know, the chemicals in your brain really screw with you. Mm-hmm. I know that just as much as anyone. But, you know, we have to reframe things, the bad things, and we have to kind of hope for the best, because what else is there? There is literally nothing else.
pretty much. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Now, you also wrote another book about writing diverse characters. Can you give any advice, any small tips on how to write a diverse character, and what is your definition of a diverse character?
Well, I mean, a diverse character, you know, the notion of the word diversity, it just means variety. Okay. You know, for a lot of people, as soon as you say diversity, they think that you mean race, or they think that you mean LGBT, or female leads as well. We'll come under that, because, of course, female leads are so much less prevalent than male leads. So those are the three that people immediately think of. And then I would also say, well, disabled characters are a thing as well. It's actually shocking how little diversity there is in showing the disabled experience on screen. It's really, really surprising if you actually break it down how many disabled characters you see. You know, nearly always wheelchair users, nearly always male, nearly always white. They nearly always want to kill themselves. It's
pretty sad. It's actually pretty sad.
It is really sad.
The My Left Foots of the world are rare.
Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate, because, you know, 1 in 5 people in the UK and the US have a disability of some kind. And there's many, many in what they call invisible disabilities as well, that people can't necessarily understand. Because they physically can't see them, but they create, you know, massive challenges in people's lives. We also tend to see disabled people only in drama, because drama is about struggle, and we able-bodied people immediately think, oh well, if you're disabled, then your life is bad, which of course is nonsense, is absolute bilge. And so it's really great to see more and more disabled characters in genre pieces. So, for example, Furiosa would be the obvious choice there.
She was great.
She was so good. And she didn't just have a disability. She had essentially an upgrade, because had she not had the robot arm, then Max would have fallen from the rig and gone under the wheels of the truck. And of course she saves him, and she would never have been able to grab him like that with her normal arm. She could only grab him with her robot arm. And we've seen robot arms a lot in Hollywood, which I always find really intriguing. You know, Bucky from Marvel has got a robot arm. He's now got a vibranium arm that, you know, Wakanda gave to him. Detective Spooner, played by Will Smith in The iRobot in 2005. He had a robot arm as well. And we've seen other robot arms in general. And of course, the Mad Max universe has always placed disability at its heart, right from the very first movie across the franchise. And so I would like to see more characters you know, in disabled story worlds where people, you know, have issues to do with their disability, but not necessarily their whole story. I would love to see that. I would love to see more working class characters, especially from UK writers. You know, we have a bit of a hang up on lords and ladies and all that kind of stuff over here.
Is there? I heard there's a wedding going on.
Yeah, what's that? I've no idea. No, seriously, I was on a train last week, and one of the thing came over the tannoy saying, "Oh, that there's going to be major disruption on the line next weekend." And I thought, "What the hell's happening next weekend?" And I had to Google to find out it was the royal wedding. I was like, "That's how disinterested the average British person is in the royal wedding."
Oh no, but we're obsessed. They're obsessed about it here. I mean, obsessed. It's
yeah.
Insane.
My sister lives in Australia, and they're obsessed with it over there as well. And you know, all my Australian friends and American friends keep saying, "Oh, you're ready for the royal wedding." It's like, how can I be ready for the royal wedding? I'm not going. Everybody, you know, people assume that everybody in Britain is going to this wedding. It's so funny.
I guess it's because we don't have, you know, kings and queens here. So I guess that's the thing. I guess it's like, I don't know why Americans are so enthralled with it. For so much. I'm not. I just, every time I turn the television on, I see these guys, I'm like, I know way too much. I know way too much about the wedding already, and I'm not even following it.
Yeah, I've managed to mute and unfollow pretty much everyone who likes the wedding now. So I've managed to be in blissful ignorance. So that's great.
Now, so again, one last question I want to ask you. How do you construct a proper pitch? Because I know that's such a difficult thing for writers and for filmmakers in general to pitch their ideas. In your opinion, how do you construct a proper pitch?
Well, I would say the first thing you need is to think about your logline and how you actually communicate your story in the logline. I often talk on Bang to Write about what I call the three C's of a good logline. So we're talking about clarity, which is obvious. It's got to be clear. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't believe how many loglines just aren't clear. And so you don't really know what's happening. And so a really good thing to do is to check for clarity always and post them in places like, well, the Bang to Rights Facebook group will have you know, you can write it on the wall and all the Bang to Writers will chime in and give their feedback on the log lines. And that really works, especially on clarity issues, because then you've got like very often 10 or even 15 people will chime in with their feedback. And if they're not getting it, then you know that you've got a problem. There's another great website called Logline It. So it's logline.it. Mm-hmm. And you can actually put your log lines up there and ask for feedback. Another one that you can do is Reddit has a great group called just called Screenwriting. Mm-hmm. And you can put your log line up there. You do have to be fairly strong stomached to.
Oh, yes. Anytime you go onto Reddit, you have to have a strong stomach.
Yeah, you do. So if you get upset easily, don't go on Reddit is my advice.
Aren't they just brutal? Like, they're the worst. Brutal.
Oh, God. Absolutely. Brutal. I mean, there was this guy on Reddit the other week. I mean, he was going on and on and on at me. I had to mute him in the end. He was going on about how I hadn't done anything in my career and how I was really sad and blah, blah, blah. I was like, whoa, why are you unleashing so much vitriol on me? I mean, for God's sake. But, you know, whatever. It's
exactly.
His problem.
Exactly.
Problem. He's living in a very sad place, no doubt. But so Reddit can be brutal. But in the Bang to Writers Facebook group, we're always very, you know, the whole point of it is moral support. Sure. And peer review. So, you know, by all means, put your log lines there. So clarity would be the first C of the three C's. Character is another one. So, you know, who is in this? What is their motivation? What is the point of them being in this thing? And very often we have the same kind of characters, even in log lines. One thing I've noticed over the years is what I call the negative adjective female. And there's always, you know, the guilt-stricken young woman or the bereaved mother or the... Right. Whatever you know, something really negative, and then she has to overcome something, you know, even in a genre piece. And it's like, oh my God, why can't we just have a kick-ass female spy for once? Why do they all have to be guilt-ridden? Why do they all have to be traumatized? It's like, oh my God, you know. So again, that can flag up some really interesting things. And then the last one would be conflicts. You know, what is the situation that this character finds themselves in? So we're talking clarity, character, conflict. That's the three C's and the keys of a good logline. From there, I would say, in terms of pitching, especially if you're pitching in real life, like at a pitch fest or on, you know, one of those, you know, Skype meetings that you can book with various producers and stuff now. The first thing I would say is introduce yourself, you know, who you are, whether you have any credits, and actually say what you're going to be pitching, whether you're going to be pitching a feature or a short film or a TV.
Just don't jump into it.
No, don't just read out your log lines. I've had a lot of very bad pitches over the years where they basically just kind of sit down and go, and blah, and just bark a log line at you. And you're like, whoa, what's going on?
We're human beings. Remember that.
Exactly, you know, and it's really, really good if you can make some sort of connection. All the best pitches I've ever heard, someone sat down and said something like, oh, hi, I've read your blog. I really liked your article about blah. I know you like female leads. I know you like thrillers. So I'm going to be pitching a thriller feature for you today. And I'm immediately thinking, oh, this person's done their homework. They know what they're talking about. They know me. They know of me. And it just gives you a good kind of connection at the beginning of the pitch. You don't have to say you like things if you don't. But if you have happened to have watched something that someone's made or read their articles or something, you know, you have some sort of like prior knowledge or you've met them before, maybe, you know, I had a good pitch only the other week when a lady came in and said, oh, hi, we met at Women in Film and TV, which is a union for women who work in film and television here in the UK. And so we met there before.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And we had a little chat quickly about that first, and then she told me her logline, and you know, we had that kind of sense of connection and rapport, and of course. Also, I remembered her afterwards, and that's always helps. So, yeah, introduce yourself, say what you're pitching, say your log line, try and deliver it conversationally if you can. Don't just read it out, and then be available for questions about it. And before you go to the pitch, try and think of the questions that they might ask. I mean, that doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to cover all of them, but to actually have an idea of what they might say will give you confidence, and confidence is what always powers a good pitch.
Very cool. Now, can you tell me a little bit about Bang to Write and the good work you're doing over there?
Bang to Write is it started off as a screenwriting blog only, and then over the years it started to kind of change, and I started to talk about characterization generally. I started moving more into script editing as well as script reading, so I got commissioned to write those two books on writing, which in turn got me more jobs on working on dramas and thrillers in particular. So I started to kind of really talk about genre, really talk about drama, especially because I found myself talking about thriller and horror a lot. So I talk a lot on the blog about drama, a lot about thriller, a lot about horror. Started talking more and more about diverse characters as well, which that led into the third book. But also one thing that I noticed over the years was that people, you know, writers really wanted to connect with me. And so I created the Facebook group, which is really lively and really connected and really engaged now. And so I'm kind of bringing that back and forth between the main site and the social media kind of pages, and also the main Bang to Write group. So whatever they're talking about in the group, I will make sure that I write about on the main site, because I know that it will, you know, power the site and power the chat in the thing, and increase the sense of community and just make it more cohesive. And one thing that I noticed that the Bang to Writers really liked was things like quotes and success quotes and inspirational quotes. So I put a lot of quotes on the blog and what we can learn from them as writers. I did one recently about Rocky and how he's the patron saint of writers, because I really think that I think It's great because he's so motivational and he's so spiritual and he's so, you've got to go out there and do it, which is something that I truly believe as well. And also in terms of other things they like. They like productivity articles. So, you know, how to get writing done. You know, there's a lot of writers out there who have, you know, very diminished windows in which to write. I know I do. I mean, I'm a professional writer as well. I write novels and blog copy and, you know, I'm just writing stuff all the time, constantly. But I still have less time than I want to write my own speculative work as well. You know, I've just been planning a project recently that, you know, I haven't even shown to my agent yet. It's just a story that I have. I feel a burning desire to tell. But I know that I've got a million other things to do first. So I'm going to have to do it on, you know, keep it on the back burner and keep writing, you know, 1,000 words here, 1,000 words there, just like the banked writers who may still have day jobs in completely unrelated things. Mm-hmm. So I write a lot about productivity. I write a lot about self-belief and motivation as well, especially when the banked writers have been through, you know, really bad rejections. Because one of the great things about banked writers on Facebook is that when somebody is rejected, they might post in there and say, oh, I've been rejected. And everyone's like, oh, chin up. It'll be all right. You know, keep going, all that kind of stuff. Because only other writers really know what it's like to be rejected. You know, I can say, I mean, I got rejected yesterday and my husband came home. And I told him I'd been rejected, and he was like, oh no. And he went out and got me a bottle of wine, which is very nice of him. Mm-hmm. But I know that he's not a writer. He doesn't know what it's really like to be rejected. So the first thing I did was get on the phone to some of my writer friends and say, oh, I'll be rejected. And immediately they're like, ah, oh, nightmare, you know. And I'll do the same for them as well. And we do the same in the Facebook group as well. So yeah, we talk about you know, loads of different things. We talk about novel writing more and more as well, because of course I'm getting really into that. I love writing my novels, and it's just because it's nice to have a change as well, because I spend so long reading screenplays and sure. So long, you know, writing stuff. It's sometimes nice just to write in a completely different medium. Although I actually think of screenplays and novels as being the same. I certainly outline them in the same way, you know, with the three acts and character motivations and role functions and all that kind of stuff. I do them exactly the same way. It's just novels are 3 times longer and a bit more psychological as well.
Now, but, you also write nonfiction books as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I will write... Yeah, I even write those really with 3 acts, to be honest.
And what are those 3 books that I know off the top of my head? Is the one the writing drama,
writing? That's thriller? Right, writing and selling drama screenplays, writing and selling thriller screenplays, and then it's writing diverse characters for fiction, TV, and film. So that third one actually incorporates novels as well, because of course we're talking predominantly about characters, mm-hmm. and of course character, whether you've got a character in a screenplay or a character in a novel, you know, they're the same thing. They're just presented differently, but other than that, they have the same kind of genetic makeup.
Very cool. Makeup. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions that I ask all of my guests. It's going to be kind of like speed round. What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
I would say get a website and do online networking as much as possible. Learn about what it is to do good online networking via social media and via your blog, and actually how to bring people to you. So in other words, create a platform. I think that's really, really important. Looking back, I did that kind of instinctively, and it's really helped me in good stead.
Very cool. Now, can you tell me what book had the biggest impact on your life or career?
Oh, blimey, there's been so many. I mean, I read about 100 books a year, so it's difficult to say, really. Is it fiction or nonfiction?
Either one. Just something that comes to your head.
I think for me, weirdly, the one that kind of really sticks out for me, when, and I probably... and I probably recommend the most to people would probably be Weave World by Clive Barker, because it made such a massive impression on me as a, like a 13-year-old schoolgirl. I mean, it was filthy in so many ways, and but also
it's Clive Barker.
Highly imaginative and so visual. It was so massively visual. And I went on to read all his other ones like Image Occur and The Midnight Meat Train and all his comic books and all his freaky, weird stuff, Cabal and all that kind of stuff. And it made a massive, massive impression on me. Even though I don't write fantasy, just the visuals of it, they never left me. And I can, even when I think of those words, I can see them in my head. I wanted to be like him. And really, you know, and hopefully one day I will be as good as him.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Don't take things personally, I think.
Especially when you're on Reddit.
I mean, sometimes people kind of get under my skin, but 9 times out of 10 now they just bounce off me. It just doesn't bother me, especially online. And certainly because I've started to notice when you have a massive online platform, you start to notice the trolls and the negative people say exactly the same things exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. And so the more you're exposed to it, the more you become immune to it. It's kind of like a mad online kind of vaccination, if you like. So it's quite rare that things really bother me online. Unfortunately, in real life, when things happen, they really still can get me down even now. Having said that, I recover a lot quicker than I used to. It used to be that, you know, if something happened with my family or something happened in my marriage or something like that, it would take me, you know, I wasn't resilient. It took me ages to kind of recover from it emotionally. But now, because I've been doing lots of work on myself about that, I think I'm much better than I used to be, definitely. So, yeah, don't take things too personally, especially not in the industry, because people say things.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
When they just work on the basis that they don't mean it, and if they do mean it, just tell them to go, you know, F themselves.
Okay. And three of your favorite films of all time.
First one has to be Alien. Left a huge, huge indelible mark. I watched it when I was about 11.
That would do it. That'll do it.
Yeah, and I was really shocked, and it just totally overwhelmed me, and I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And then I rewrote Alien in my various notebooks for about 5 years afterwards, just writing the same thing about a girl going into space and getting attacked by monsters. And some of them were all right, actually. I've got a couple of my notebooks and think, maybe I should do something with some of those someday. So yeah, if you ever see a space story from me about a girl being attacked by monsters, as you know why. Another one that really kind of made a massive impact on me would be Blue Valentine, the drama starring Ryan Gosling.
Great movie.
So good. Another Cassian Newell's one, actually, that he produced. And it was so good. It was so true, you know, about, you know, the nature of divorce and love and, the relationship between men and women.
It was brutal.
It was so brutal and so true and so beautiful and tragic and just awful. And oh God, it was so good. I really, really loved it. So yeah, Blue Valentine would be another one. And I think the other one would be Toy Story, because I was about 14 when that movie came out. And I remember, you know, I'd never really seen 3D animation before that. I mean, I know it was around, but I don't remember ever seeing it. Certainly never seen a movie with it. And I remember going to the cinema and I remember being dragged to see it because I was like, oh, I don't want to go and see a kid's movie. I'm a grown up. And I was like, wow, I could not believe my eyes. I mean, actually, when you look at the first Toy Story now, it looks quite dated in comparison.
Yes.
Story 3, but at that time that was the best they could do, and I was amazed by it, and I was also amazed by the fact that it was a family movie rather than just for kids. And I just loved all the, you know, like, hey, I'm Picasso and his face is on sideways, you know, the potato head and stuff like that. And I remember getting it and laughing, and I was the only one that laughed in the cinema. embarrassed. But it was because I live in Devon in the UK, which is tiny, and there was only about 20 people in the cinema. Sure. And but I remember thinking, why don't the grown-ups get it? And that's when I started to think, ooh, you know, there's such a thing as a literary illusion, and there's such a thing as subtext, and there's such a thing as these things that are put in, you know, these in-jokes for grown-ups and for cultured people in things that are comedy and stuff like that. I started to notice different things and how you could be 14 and get a cultural reference like that, but a grown-up sitting next to me didn't get it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Different responses to different things. Not everybody's the same. And so, you know, all of these movies really kind of, you know, set off things in my head, as it were. I mean, because of Blue Valentine, that's when I wanted to write the drama screenplays book. So when my publisher said to me, you know, do you want to write another writing book, the first thing I thought of was Blue Valentine. I thought, I want to write something about that somehow. Right. I want to kind of do, you know, look into what drama is and what the minutiae of that thing is, because drama can be anything. It can literally be anything. Yeah. So how do you put it down? You know, at least with thriller, you know that thriller thrills, and it's got to be thrilling in some way. And it's got to be about chase. It's got to be about mystery, or in it. So that chase is figurative or sure. literal. But, you know, what is drama? What is it? And what is it that makes me interested in it when something is so devastating as, say, Blue Valentine versus something like Little Miss Sunshine, which is not devastating at all, but it still has pathos in it. So what is the difference? And so, yeah, that set that off and made me think, yeah, what is this thing about emotional truth in drama?
Now, where can people find you and your work?
Well, you can find me all over the internet. I'm like germs. I get everywhere. So if you Google my name, Lucy V. Hay, H-A-Y, you'll find me. If you Google Lucy Hay, you'll find the Countess of Carlisle in Scotland. I can't win against her, unfortunately, because she's a historical figure from the 16th century.
Sure.
If you Google Lucy V. Hay, you'll find me. If you Google Bang to Write, you'll find me. B-A-N-G, number 2, W-R-I-T-E. That's one word. And I'm bangtowrite.com. I'm lucyvhayauthor.com as well. And I'm basically on all of the platforms. I'm on Reddit. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram. You know,
awesome.
you're tripping over me. I'm literally everywhere.
Well, I'll make sure to put those links and also links to your books in the show notes. Lucy, it's been wonderful talking to you for this last hour. Thank you so much for dropping some nice knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Lucy, for dropping some knowledge bombs on the tribe today. If you want to get more information about Lucy and her work at Bang to Write, just head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/BPS025, where I'll put links to everything we spoke about in this episode. And guys, if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and leave a good review on iTunes. It is so, so helpful to the show, and it helps the rankings of the show, and I really want to get all this information out to as many screenwriters and filmmakers as humanly possible. So that's screenwritingpodcast.com. And that does it for another episode of the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast. Thank you so much for your support. I hope this episode was of service to you on your journey as a writer, as a creator, and as an artist. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast at bulletproofscreenplay.com. That's BULLETPROOFSCRENPLAY.com.